Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of a report into corruption in South Africa that President Zuma has tried to block, which has sparked widespread outrage with thousands of protesters taking to the streets and marching on Zuma's offices in Pretoria. Catherine Newman, the Dean of the Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa, joins us to discuss the growing movement to have Zuma step down. We'll examine Zuma's relationship with the wealthy Gupta family and his lavish spending of government funds to upgrade his rural home, and whether Zuma will become a liability to the ruling ANC party, which is losing its popularity as it faces national elections in 2019. Then we'll speak with David Redlawsk, Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware and author of The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. He joins us to discuss the sudden swing in the polls, slowing Hillary Clinton's momentum and reversing Trump's downward slide to where the latest Washington Post ABC poll has Trump ahead nationally by 1 point. We will look into how national polls compare to polls in critical swing states and whether FBI Director James Comey's letter is a sufficient explanation for the sudden reversal of Hillary Clinton's fortune and if other factors are at play. Then finally, we'll examine the record spending of $126 million by the drug industry to kill Proposition 61 on the California ballot, which Senator Bernie Sanders is campaigning in support of, saying it would be, quote, a real blow against this greedy industry that will reverberate all over America. Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985, and the author of The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaign, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit, joins us. We'll discuss the outside corporate money pouring into California's election and whether the ballot initiative process itself that was meant to empower the people has been co-opted by the moneyed interests. And joining us now is Catherine Newman, the Dean of the Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, including The Accordion Family, The Missing Class, and After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Newman.
Thank you so much, Ian. Good to be with you.
And thank you for joining us. The president of South Africa has been dogged by scandal for quite some time now, and he seems to have dodged the bullet on spending something close to $20 million of government funds to upgrade his rural home. And I think he paid a very small fine, you know, less than a million. 7.8 million rand. Now he's been holding up this report on corruption, this anti-graft watchdog group he finally, I guess he gave in on the legal appeals to block it. And it's hit South Africa like a hurricane. I mean, you've got thousands of people taken to the streets, marching on his offices in Pretoria. And you've got this fissure in the ANC between the young reformers and the old guard that support Zuma. So how do you see this playing out? It just seems like the voices are gathering across the country to have him step down.
Well, we've been here before, and so I think it's very difficult to predict the future. Zuma is a remarkably resilient and wily politician. He's been accused of corruption, as you noted, many times over. The split within the ANC was already there before. I think the big difference is that there were some major losses in the last elections that were surprising to people. A great deal of momentum for the Democratic Alliance, a bigger vote share for the EFF. So I think there's the biggest difference between the present and the last round of these corruption charges is that there's been more visible political weakening that the ANC has suffered. But it's not the first time he's been accused of major corruption, and he manages to surmount this every time. Now, you are right that the demonstrations in Pretoria are of a larger scale than anything that we saw before, but the degree of cynicism and despair over this man's failings as a politician are pronounced and have been for years now. So I think we will have to kind of wait and see whether this momentum is sufficient to lose the kind of clout he's had within the ANC. That has not been the case before, despite pretty pronounced corruption charges.
But when the Nelson Mandela Foundation, which of course Mandela being the founder of post-apartheid Democratic South Africa, or at least the first leader and an internationally revered figure, when yes. they go public, which they never have, they've stayed above politics, when they go public and say, it is painful for us to bear witness to the wheels coming off the vehicle of our state. That's a pretty mm-hmm. big statement. That goes beyond corruption.
It is a very big statement, and it may well be sufficient to knock Zuma over this time. I merely am noting that there have been such extraordinary charges against him before that I would have thought this would have happened before. But, you know, as you say, it may be that this is finally loud enough and long enough to bring him down. I should add that there are other background features that make him more vulnerable right now. It makes the particular charges of fiscal corruption all the more painful, and that is the widespread strikes in the universities in Joburg and in Cape Town and elsewhere against rising tuition, which is a real flashpoint for young people in South Africa because it splits along racial lines and along generational lines. And that has already been roiling the country with university shutdowns for long periods of time and tremendous unrest. So this charge against Zuma is particularly poignant, I think, because it's against the backdrop of thousands of young people who feel that sort of fiscal disaster is, including the devaluation of the currency, is going to make their access to higher education forever compromised. So that's another factor that makes this, I think, a particularly poignant moment, because if the state doesn't have enough money to fund its universities, but it's being, you know, ransacked by a corrupt politician, that juxtaposition is morally completely indefensible and I think may well add to the fuel to the fire.
And again, I'm speaking with Catherine Newman, who's the Dean of the Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and the author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. So just to focus on the charges, or at least what's been revealed in this report by the public prosecutor, who's a very popular woman, by the way, who Zuma has been trying to get rid of. I think she's finally stepping down.
Yes, I think he did successfully get rid of her.
Right, but this is like
milk toast in her place.
Right, but this is her parting volley, if you will. This mm-hmm. 355-page report entitled "State of Capture," and arguably the South African government has always been in a kind of state of capture by the powerful interests, like the mining interests, the billionaires, going back to Cecil Rhodes, you know, the whole history. But in this case, it does seem pretty tawdry. And in fact, you've got the heads of these big mining companies calling for Zuma to step down. And it looks as though Zuma's son, Duduzane, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes, that's right.
Duduzane, he's kind of the bag man for the father, and mm-hmm. he's been shaking down this Gupta family of billionaire brothers, Indian South Africans, who seem to have an enormous amount of business, but the government basically was essentially giving away its assets, like power. Grids and power plants, et cetera, like that. So it's the level of plundering here is pretty extraordinary.
Yes, I would say it's sort of on the level of Russian plundering. It's an extreme scale. And again, it takes place against the backdrop of some truly desperate poverty in and service delivery failures all over the country. So it's not just the plundering, it's the contrast of this enormous payoffs and looting of what are supposed to be national resources, while meanwhile millions of people go without power, without water, without houses, and the rising youth generation without educational opportunity. I think it's really the juxtaposition of these unfortunate trends that make this all the more catastrophic a scandal. I mean, it would be bad enough if the country was on the move in these other domains, but it's stagnating or worse, and the falling value of the currency is hurting them. Just about every indicator is going in the wrong direction, and so these scandals, which are profiting a small handful of elites, are just all the more outlandish under these circumstances.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary that the three Gupta brothers, Ajay, Atul, and Rajesh Gupta, they only arrived in South Africa from India in 1993, and they've become incredibly wealthy very quickly. And they're so close to Jacob Zuma that the opposition party in South Africa refer to the Guptas as the Zuptas.
So, yes, I know. I know.
As I was saying earlier about state capture, I mean, the nationalist government under apartheid was essentially a form of state capture, where this political party, had a symbiotic relationship with all of the powerful mining interests, etc. There's nothing new about that. So how do you see this in terms of the post-apartheid South Africa? The greatest tragedy of all would be that South Africa went down the unfortunate path of so many other African countries to the north of them, and right to the north of them, of course, is Zimbabwe, which is a complete basket case.
By the way,
tomorrow, Thursday, Zuma goes to Harare to Zimbabwe to meet with the aging leader there, the kleptocratic dictator.
So, yes. Well, in the years that I was doing the field research with my colleague Ariane Delanois for After Freedom, the worry about South Africa's future was very pronounced among the post-apartheid generation. A lot of worry that it would be vulnerable to going the route of Zimbabwe, of a total sort of collapse into corrupt dictatorship. However, I do think there is greater resilience and strength in South African democratic institutions. It may be odd to say that under these circumstances, but the courts are more resilient. There is a free press that hasn't been completely kiboshed. There are democratic institutions to try and call people to account. I'm not suggesting they've been effective all the time. They haven't been, or Zuma wouldn't still be standing where he is. But relative to other countries that have suffered the kind of complete collapse of political institutions, I would not describe South Africa that way. What I would say is that it has not yet found a post-apartheid political class that is capable of exercising legitimate power. The South African politicians have for a long time rested their laurels on their role during the anti-apartheid movement itself. I mean, that was Zuma's original claim to legitimacy, and it remained the claim to legitimacy up until the most recent elections. And that is no longer sufficient for the kinds of qualities that are needed in leaders. They need good politicians with strong morals, with an eye toward a legitimate democracy, with a respect for the powers of the institutions, with an anti-corruption strain that means something. And it has been surprisingly difficult to identify people who can carry the day. Now, that has started to change. We've started to see less of a one-party state, elections starting to swing toward the DA. That's been true in the western part of the country for a long time, but it started to be true elsewhere in the last set of elections. But I think... So I guess my answer is a very mixed one. On the one hand, I do think their institutions are stronger and more resilient than you would ever say about Zimbabwe. But I would also say that finding the kind of new voice of the next generation has proven remarkably difficult. And we're going to have to see that people like Zuma get out of the way and people like the minister he just ousted take his place.
Well, Zuma and his loyalists tried to get rid of the finance minister.
Yes.
And the South African people fought back, and obviously the motive there was to get their hands on the treasury and get mm-hmm. get all those government contracts. So, I mean, they're not exactly subtle, are they?
No, they're not. But you know, I do think that will be their. I would like to think, I should say, that will be their undoing in the end, because I do think there is greater respect in the country as a whole for the rule of law. But it's not. It is very vulnerable to cynicism because it cannot be proven to be effective now. It should have, this regime should have been chucked out a long time ago. So there is a real tension in South Africa between the ideals that Mandela generation gave everything for and the reality of what has transpired since Mandela stepped down and the current version of the ANC took power. It's been a rampant disappointment. And, you know, the courts have struck back. Some political parties have tried to rally. It's been a weak rallying, but it's not, I don't think it would be fair to say that it is equivalent to Zimbabwe, at least not right now.
No, well, I wasn't suggesting that. I was just saying that is it on that sort of trajectory? Because
it's always a fear,
right?
It's always a fear. I don't think it's on that trajectory, but it will have to achieve a degree of legitimacy soon, or that worry will get to be too pronounced. And if the currency collapse continues, it will lead to such extraordinary economic hardship that almost anything is possible.
Well, just in closing then, given that the ANC has suffered electoral losses and apparently their popularity is waning, and you have that internal split between the young reformers and the old guard, how pragmatic are they? In other words, they're standing by him, and the unions that are the kind of core support mm-hmm. for the ANC, some of them are splitting off, but most of them are standing by Zuma. Will there be a kind of a slow defection just out of political survival?
Well, I think there could be if it really looks like Zuma's ship is sinking. But as you say, people are remarkably attuned to their own self-interest, which, of course, is why Zimbabwe has lasted in its condition as long as it has. If you put that many people on your payroll, you will have an army of people keeping you in power, even if, you know, you're almost dead, which is more or less what's going on in Zimbabwe. So I think it's very difficult to predict the future. I do think Zuma is in a much more precarious state than he was before, and those by-elections were a shot across the bow. The sort of increasing visibility of the DA, which was really not a very major power outside of the Western Cape until quite recently, that is a kind of handwriting on the wall. And I guess I'll just be watching along with you, Ian, to see what happens next.
Well, Catherine Newman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I mean, speaking with Catherine Newman, who's the Dean of the Arts and Sciences and a Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She is the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality. And she's also the author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest polls, some of which have Donald Trump ahead of Hillary Clinton nationally, and try and understand why this swing or why her momentum has slowed and Donald Trump's momentum has increased. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Radlorsk, Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. He's the co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Voting Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And his latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Radlorsk.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And David, apropos your latest book, The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning, that's pretty much what we're down to in this last week. And both of them are just going after each other with as much venom as they could muster. But how do you explain this reversal of the momentum that Hillary Clinton seemed to have until this FBI letter just seemed to stop it dead in her tracks, and then suddenly it's revived Trump? And I can't believe that this shift in the polls and shift in the momentum can solely be attributed to the FBI letter.
Well, Ian, it can't. And in fact, there are dueling theories out there about whether there has been any shift. And, you know, the problem for Hillary Clinton isn't whether or not there's actually been a shift. It's whether or not the media perceives one and how it ends up talking about the state of the campaign in these last few days. Depending on whose average you look at, let's say Real Clear Politics versus the Huffington Post, they do different things. But in both cases, Clinton is up. In the case of the Huffington Post, their average has her up actually almost 6 points across all the polling that has been coming out. Real Clear Politics makes it about, it's something less than 2 points. The reality is probably somewhere in between those numbers, at least if we kind of look at the samples and look at, you know, the kind of thing we saw 4 years ago, where President Obama was up only about a point, a little more than a point in the averages ahead of Election Day, and of course he won by over 4 points.
So is there a difference then, or is there are this national poll, for example, this Washington Post ABC poll? Surely the swing state polls, would they tell you more?
Well, certainly, because it's actually a state-by-state election, of course. Right. But let me address ABC Washington Post for a moment, because that's the one everyone's keying on, since it represents a massive swing from a 12-point Clinton lead to a small Trump lead, maybe tied somewhere, you know, around there in the last couple of days. That's a big change. But it turns out, as best we can tell, and not every piece of data is public that we would need, some of that change, maybe almost all of that change, is related to who's actually in the sample each day. And that's a really, really important point for people paying attention to polls, which is, these polls are polling generally new samples every day. There are some trackers that use panels, but most are using new samples that they're adding to old samples. And what happens after something like Friday is we find partisans whose side was hurt by an event actually tend to be less likely to answer polls in the immediate term after. So if, in fact, Democrats became slightly less likely to answer ABC Washington Post compared to where they were before, you would see the kinds of swings that they're showing. No other poll has shown this big a swing. I think people need to minimize the focus on single polls and look at the big picture. But as you say, looking at state by state is frankly more important. No one cares what the national numbers are going to be in the end. It's going to be which states do the candidates win. And at the moment, Trump's path remains quite difficult.
Well, I did this monthly forum at the UCLA Hema Forum in Westwood, here in Los Angeles, at UCLA,
yeah,
or nearly UCLA. And a couple of years back, we did a forum with Dan Schnur, who's with John McCain's presidential campaign, and Bill Zimmerman, who's run a bunch of Democratic campaigns. And it was just purely talking to a couple of presidential campaign veterans to figure out what it's all about.
Yeah.
And the most depressing thing that they said, both of them said, was that in the last week or so of the election, that's when the low information voters suddenly wake up and think, oh, there's an election, and then they start paying attention. Now, if you haven't paid attention after, what, almost 2 years of this extraordinarily expensive barrage of presidential coverage, the idea that at the end of the day, the fate of the nation is in the hands of the least engaged and perhaps the least intelligent, without being too disparaging here, is really appalling. Now, is that a possible factor here, that the sort of, the low information people are waking up and starting to think they may have to vote?
It's certainly possible, but the reality is that portion of the electorate, no matter what the campaigns look at the very end, is actually a pretty tiny portion of the electorate. It's going to matter in places that are razor thin margins on either side. But for the most part, those people who are really low information end up in the non-voter category, right? Remember that maybe 60%, or if we're really lucky, 65% of registered voters will actually show up to vote. The ones who don't are the ones who typically call themselves independents or no party, and they typically don't know much about what's going on. So I don't discount that low information voter theory. I think campaigns know what they're doing, but I don't think it swings elections except potentially where it's just absolutely dead even.
There was one little bit of information that came out from Florida where we're told that 28% of the GOP's early voters voted for Hillary Clinton. And this is a Target Smart William & Mary poll released Tuesday. So that's in itself pretty extraordinary. Is that what's going on in terms of, if there's any fallout from the Comey letter, what it's perhaps doing is that it's stopping the bleeding of Republicans who can't stomach Trump, who are voting for Hillary, and now because they've revived this idea of her emails and scandal, et cetera, even though the scandal is unrelated to her, it's this ridiculous disgraced congressman we're talking about. Nevertheless, it's sort of she's been slimed by it, and therefore the Republicans that voted early for her are now going back to Trump. Is that what's happening?
Well, I mean, there could be some of that. We could be seeing some movement by rank-and-file Republicans back over towards Trump. But look, it's not dramatic because the vast, vast majority of Republicans in most polls have been Trump supporters in recent months, just as the vast, vast majority of Democrats in the polls have been Hillary Clinton supporters. Partisanship is a really strong drug, and it really drives partisans to come home to their party almost always. That number about early voting in Florida, let's be careful. The way numbers are being thrown about on early voting, people may be thinking we know how people voted. We don't, right? Those votes will not be made public until election night. But what we have in that particular case is one poll that suggested the very small, tiny sample of Republicans already voted, and it's a small share of the total poll, were much more Hillary Clinton than you'd expect. I would be quite dubious about that figure unless there were other polls showing something very similar.
Yeah, the poll surveyed 718 people, 311 of whom said they had voted early through the web, via web and phone interviews. So that is a small sample.
Right, but only a small share of those, right? About a third or so, 40% would be Republicans.
Right.
So we're talking a sample of around 100 people.
Right. So what then is the we are talking about Florida here, of course, and that's key.
Right.
If Trump doesn't win Florida, he doesn't become president. If Hillary Clinton wins it, she becomes president. It's almost that simple, isn't it?
It is almost that simple, although there are some other states in a similar vein. Trump can win Florida and still end up not coming close to being president because of places like Pennsylvania and Nevada, and the fact that he's battling in some states where a Republican shouldn't be battling. But, you know, if you're a Clinton supporter at this point, I actually think in a weird way, the Comey letter did the campaign a favor, because I think people were beginning to coast. They were beginning to believe these almost outlier numbers about how well she was doing. And I think this puts it back into, you know, we better get the voters out to vote. One thing I think, again, if you're on the Clinton side, you can hold on hope on really two things. One is the get out the vote operation by the Clinton campaign, by all accounts, is, you know, just hugely, hugely better than the Donald Trump get out the vote operation. And secondly, most of this polling appears to be probably not giving Clinton enough non-white votes. A great example is Investors Business Daily, which shows it tied 44-44, but they're only showing 74% for Clinton among blacks, right? There's no world in which that's true. Just like the LA Times tracking that puts Trump way up shows only 53% of Hispanics supporting Clinton. Latino Decisions, which only interviews Hispanics in both English and Spanish, shows 75% support for Clinton.
So you don't buy that New York Times story that came out today that's suggesting that that Hillary Clinton has the support amongst African American is flagged and faded since the peak of support for Barack Obama.
It's not about her support fading. That is, African Americans remain basically just as strongly Democratic in Hillary Clinton as they were Obama. The question, and we don't know the answer yet, is turnout.
Right. Are they motivated to vote?
Right. And that's a critical question that all we can do is speculate at this point. The early voting numbers are not really a good indication of what's going to happen.
But are there any indications, since this is the first election since the Voting Rights Act, or Section 5, the preclearance part of it's been struck down, and there's the election protection is going to be very active. Yeah. There's already, the courts have struck down a lot of these strict ID laws, but they managed to, you know, even in Texas and other places at the local level, they've kind of defying the courts. And in Wisconsin, much of the draconian new rules have prevailed. And that, of course, is where Trump is campaigning today in Wisconsin. So is there any indication from what you've seen from the polling across the country that would indicate that this is going to be impact, the voter suppression factor is going to impact this election?
So there have been some studies on, for example, voter ID laws, many of which seem to show no real effect. But there's been a more recent study, and now, of course, I can't pull the name of it out of my head, that showed it could have a 2 or 3 point effect on turnout. And that's just the ID laws. There are states where polling places have been eliminated. It's become more difficult to get out the vote, even for early voters. And you are seeing some of that. I think African American early vote looks down in Florida, for example, compared to 2012. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean they're not going to vote. It just means, it may be on election day. Let's not, however, be sanguine about that. There are plenty of efforts underway to make it difficult for some people to get to the polls, and particularly for minority voters to get to the polls. And, Democrats who will be supported by minority voters are going to have to be awfully vigilant on election day.
Well, maybe because there was a hurricane down there in Florida, maybe that disrupted the early voting. Yeah. I mean, and also the governor, didn't he cut it back? Didn't Governor Rick Scott cut the voting back by a week, early voting?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really hard to make these strict comparisons. Not only are there changes in polling places and rules and cutting back the dates for early voting, North Carolina is an example of that, but, there are enough changes that going and saying, well, 2016 compared to 2012, it's extraordinarily difficult. But I think that the Clinton campaign, I have no doubt they're paying careful attention to this in every way they possibly can. Because, you know, this is where we are now. The campaigns are negative at this point, which is normal at the end, although, you know, they're often negative all the way through. But a lot of that is about generating anxiety and anger and frustration. But that's not enough to get people to vote. You've also got to reach out and make them want to vote. And that's what's going on the ground right now. That's the door knocking. That's the telephone calling. And I still think the evidence is the Clinton campaign is better positioned to do that kind of groundwork.
Well, you know how much scandal has played a role, particularly that Access Hollywood video. Today, we were about to be delivered yet another woman, in this case, a woman who claims mm-hmm. when she was 13 years old, she was raped by Trump. But yeah. she was a no-show in a much ballyhooed press conference. So that we'll see whether that ever rematerializes. In terms of just the focus now, I mentioned Trump was in today in Wisconsin. Hillary Clinton was in Arizona today. We're Trump's ahead by 5 points. What does that say to you?
Well, where the candidates go in the last few days, it actually is an important signal, right? Because the most scarce thing in any campaign is the candidate's time, the candidate's presence. And the idea that Hillary Clinton is going to Arizona suggests two different things. One is that they actually think they have a shot in Arizona, although the public polling might suggest a Trump win. They must think they have a shot. They wouldn't waste time there. But I think it also suggests internally in the campaign there may be some confidence that they can send her to a place like Arizona, that it isn't, you know, that they're not desperate to go shore up support everywhere else. Now, she's going to be in, you know, the more standard swing states as well. But that signal about Arizona could be about what the campaign sees in its own numbers. It could also be a feint. It could be a way of pushing the Trump campaign to have to go do things it might not otherwise think it has to do.
So one of the conclusions of the Comey letter was, amongst a lot of analysts and pundits, was that this is going to affect the down ballot. It may not affect Hillary Clinton's chances so much as whether the Dems will take the Senate. What do you know about that? What do you think is happening there? I mean, the races are pretty tight. It looks like Marco Rubio in Florida, his lead has gone down considerably, but he's still got a bit of a lead. But there are some good chances there, I think, out there for the Democrats to pick up some seats, and I'm not sure what the effect has been of Comey's letter on that.
I don't think we have a really good handle on that from the numbers, but I think that, you know, where it could affect down ballot is, again, the question of enthusiasm, the question of people getting out to vote. If the Comey letter has the effect of depressing Democrats, then that certainly hurts in the Senate in those close races. If it has the effect of engaging Democrats, oh, we'd better get out there, that becomes an entirely different story. The Republicans have a pretty tough road to hold on to the Senate. The Democrats only need to flip 4 seats if they hold Nevada and 5 if they don't. If Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, they need one more seat, of course, if Trump wins. But they're in really pretty good shape in a number of states. Pennsylvania, for example, looks reasonably good for the Democrats. Wisconsin, although it appears to be tightening. The path for the Democrats looks better than the Republicans right now. And I think it was maybe it's 538. I honestly, you know, so many things now. But I was looking at one of the forecasts that suggested that the Democrats had at least now a 70% chance of taking the Senate. But, you know, we know a week is a lifetime in politics, and every one of those Senate campaigns is going to turn not just on national stuff, but on what's going on the ground in that state.
Well, just in closing, What will be the effect of the third and fourth party candidates, the Libertarian Gary Johnson? He seems to have slipped down from a 9% down to about, 5, I think. And then Jill Stein has gone down from about 4 to 2%. So does that basically people being more pragmatic, thinking, well, you know, at the end of the day, I can't afford the luxury of voting for a third-party candidate because, you know, if I'm a Republican, I'm alarmed at crooked Hillary, or if I'm a Democrat, I'm alarmed at the orange duce, as the conservative radio host in Wisconsin refers him. So is that a...
The path we're seeing for the other candidates, the third party candidates, right now looks like the very traditional path. A month to 6 weeks ahead of the election, there's some excitement, some polling numbers bump up. It looks like they might be getting traction. And then closer we get to the election, the lower their numbers go. The odds are higher that they will end up even lower than where they are than that they will end up higher. For exactly the reason you said, in the end, you know, voters recognize that you really are at the moment constrained to one of two choices, and failing to vote in that direction, you know, may result in a worse outcome for you than just voting for the lesser of two evils.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Redlawsk.
You're welcome, Ian. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with David Redlawsk, who's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. His latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into the record spending by the drug industry to kill Proposition 61 on the California ballot. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. His latest book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaign, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Court.
Great to be back, Ian.
And Jamie, the drug industry is spending, you have a figure of $126 million. Some other stories I've read have it at $109 million. So,
that's because they just put more money in yesterday.
I see. So your figure is the latest. I'm glad I'm using your figures. So... this is pretty amazing. You know, you've got this just money pouring in, and you've got all of this. They're dragging all kinds of the veterans. I guess they always figure you bring in the veterans, you win the argument. It's the mom and apple pie factor. But it's pretty dishonest, most of what they are doing. And I take it that you've uncovered some stuff from Wall Street that indicates that the sky is falling argument that the drug companies are putting out is bogus, that it's not going to they're not going to be impoverished by the results of 61.
If you really want to know the truth of anything, just get the transcripts of conference calls from Wall Street investment banks to their investors, because they're going to tell you how it is if they think no one's listening. And Prop 61, look, is an initiative that It's pretty simple. It says that the state of California, when it buys drugs for its health care programs, cannot pay more than the lowest price charged to the federal government, which is the Veterans Administration. And it's going to save the state money. The legislative analyst says it's going to save money. They don't know how much. Probably a billion or more for, probably 6 to 7 million people who are on the taxpayer dime here. And the drug companies have been making the argument that, look, if you do this, California, we're going to have to raise drug prices for everyone because, it's going to take such a big bite out of us. Well, the top eight companies that contributed is $126 million. The drug makers have contributed $126 million against Prop 61. The top eight companies on the list had profits that were $217 billion last year. So a billion here and a billion there, as the Wall Street analysts say, really doesn't hurt them that much. But it does get us all on the road to cheaper drug prices because it legitimizes, and this is where Wall Street analysts have told investors there's risk, it legitimizes bulk purchasing of prescription drugs as a reform that other states will adopt. One analyst said if all 50 states adopted California's program, it would probably be about a 2 to 3% hit on their profits. Now, we want to take that money back. We don't want to create a situation where the drug companies are going to change their pricing on anyone else until other states pass these laws or until the federal government finally gets bulk purchasing for Medicare. But they are scared of the precedent this sets, of the headlines, not the financial implications, as one analyst said. So I think we have a good glimpse of what's happening here. And the fact is, the public doesn't really know the drug companies are the ones against Prop 61. They're hiding behind veterans. They're hiding behind the doctors who take quite a bit of money from the drug companies. And this will not affect veterans' drug prices at all because veterans' co-pays are locked in under the federal government. This has nothing to do with veterans pay for their drugs. This has nothing to do with doctors. It is all really about trying to get cost controls and not allow them to raise the EpiPen prices so much, from $190 a two-pack to $600 a two-pack on the state of California. So I think that the danger here is the public doesn't see who's against 61, because the minute they hear who's against 61, they are yes on 61, and they're hiding. And the good thing is that the polling is very positive for Prop 61. Bernie Sanders is coming out Saturday, for those who want to come, your listeners in L.A., 10:30 or 10 o'clock at Pershing Square, and he's going to be in Sacramento at 1 at the state capitol for a rally. And Bernie is the best brand we have to say yes on 61 against that drug company money.
Well, it seems, though, that Bernie, you just told us, Jamie Court, that the drug companies are drawing a line here because they don't want California to set a precedent for the nation to suddenly discover that you don't have to be gouged anymore by drug companies if you make a stand. And on the other side, Bernie Sanders is saying that if 61 passes, it'll be a real blow against this greedy industry that will reverberate all over America. So there you have the lines are drawn, right?
The lines are drawn, and the drug companies, like I said, they just put another, $16 million in yesterday. They had put a week before another $20 million in. I mean, this is the largest amount ever spent against the ballot measure in California history, $126 million. And it'll probably go up before Election Day. I was involved in some of the other ones. There was an $80 million campaign against Prop 103, our insurance reform in 1988, and it passed with 51% of the vote and has lowered auto and home insurance rates in the state. There was a $97 million campaign by the oil companies against an oil severance tax, Prop 87, I believe, that failed years ago. The tribal entities have spent $100 million before, but $126 million is an all-time record. And I think the danger in a noisy ballot of 17 is the drug companies are making their presence known. If you see enough ads, you're going to think, well, who's paying for them? And right at this point, we're at 51% yes, according to the Hoover Institution poll, which isn't a great institution. But there's only a 28% no after the drug companies have already spent $100 million. They can't get the no vote above 30%, and the yes vote's 51%, and all the undecideds, some of them are going to come to the yes side. So at this point, days away from this election, all the polling shows the yes significantly higher than the no, and the support not really being withered a lot. And I, so a tribute to the California nurses, to the AARP, to the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, who single-handedly, frankly, is funding this initiative because they want to do the right thing. And so I'm unbelievably impressed by the public's ability to see through all the drug company money and see what's right here. And I think it's going to be on next Tuesday night a very big day, because not only will we be able to do this in other states, but it also says that Bernie Sanders, when he comes out for something, he can cut through the BS. And that would mean potentially an initiative to create a single-payer system out in the distant future if our premiums keep rising, or get any type of other reform. And if Bernie can be a force against all type of money and the public's listening, that's a huge, huge benefit to the progressive cause. So I'm excited about this as a potential win here, and also as a win for the future of progressive populism.
Let's quickly go through the propositions because I get so much mail, and I'm not, this is a national program, so we try to do national stuff. But the fact that this is a record money is pouring in out of state makes it a national story. And of course, the death penalty, which we covered yesterday, mm-hmm. is a national story because it, again, what happens in California tends to migrate to the rest of the country. 51 school bonds.
I think it's a yes. It doesn't okay. hurt. Some people say they haven't figured out the construction process, but I'm full for getting schools fixed because they're falling apart. So it's hard to be against it.
Okay, Prop 52, the Medi-Cal hospital fees, yes?
It's by the hospital industry for the hospital industry. It's probably not a bad thing, but it basically takes the power of the legislature to change the hospital fees in proportion with Medi-Cal in the future. I think you can't go wrong going no or yes on it. Personally, I'm hoping that it doesn't pass because I want the hospital industry to lose, but it's not terrible policy, so
okay.
it's a draw.
A conditional yes from you. All right. Proposition 53, the revenue bond voter approval. No?
Well, it depends. I think it's a yes. Some mm-hmm. people don't like it because it's a super farmer trying to stop Jerry Brown from doing high-speed rail and the water tunnels. But I think for big-dollar bonds, why not go to the voters? It creates a hurdle, but it's probably a legitimate hurdle.
But it is this one big property owner, right?
Yeah, it's a super farmer, 79-year-old super farmer who wants to stop the bullet train, wants to stop the Delta Water projects. Uh-huh. Definitely being an obstructionist, but as a policy, it's hard to say it's wrong to go to the voters. So,
all right, well, people are going to have to make up their minds whether they want to vote for a plutocrat or send the power back
Jerry
to the legend. There you
Jerry
go.
Brown.
Jerry Bounds is definitely fighting for Prop 53. Okay, 54.
He's fighting against Prop 53 because he wants to do his water tunnels and he wants.
Oh,
to
I'm sorry. No, yeah. Yeah. So that's why the LA Times said no, right, on 53. Okay. Yeah. So 54. This is the rich guy, right? The son of Charlie Munger.
Charlie Munger Jr.
Right.
And he wants to create something that says you got to have a bill in print for 72 hours before you vote on it. I can't say no to that. I don't care who it comes from. I don't care if it came from Satan. I'm going to vote for it.
Okay, 55, income tax extension.
Of course, I'm agnostic, so I don't believe in Satan. But I think we do the upper income tax extension because we need the money, even though the argument against it is they said it would sunset and they're just extending it. But I'm all for it because I think the taxpayers should ante up if they got the money.
Prop 56, the tobacco tax, yes?
Yay, yay.
Okay. All right, Prop 57, criminal sentencing and parole.
You know, it could go either way. I think letting people out of jail is probably not a bad idea if it's nonviolent offenders. Well, at least put some control with the parole boards, and there's a question about whether they're all nonviolent. But it's how you feel about whether the jail is being too full or too empty. I think they're probably too full right now.
So that's a yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Proposition 58, bilingual education. Yes.
I'm for it.
Okay.
For it.
59, Citizens United Constitutional Amendment.
I can't say no to that. I think
okay.
it's not going to do anything but send a message. That's a good thing.
That's a yes. Prop 60, the condom use in adult films.
You know, that's a social issue. I will not make recommendations.
Okay, all
you
right.
The First Amendment people on one side, and you got the public health
all right.
people on
well,
the other.
Let's move on because I don't have much I'm in a position on that one. 61, state prescription drug purchases.
That's our baby. That's the one that's going to change drug pricing in America. That's a big yes.
Okay.
That's the one you have to tell all your friends about in email and come out Monday to see Bernie at Pershing Square for.
Okay. Yeah. 62, repeal the death penalty. That's a yes, right?
I'm a yes. I love Mike Farrell, and I believe in it.
Yeah. Proposition 63, gun regulation.
Well, yes. If we have gun control, we won't need to put people in jail. So
right. 64, marijuana legalization.
I'm all for it, though. I don't inhale.
Okay. 65, this is the...
That's a no, because that's a trick by big plastic to attack the real plastic ban. So no on 65, yes on 67, which is the real plastic ban.
Okay.
Plastic bag ban.
So that's an important one, because they're tricksters there. 65 is a no, and a 67, both put on the ballot by the plastic bag industry, is a yes. Okay, the last one is this somewhat mendacious death penalty, Proposition 66.
Yeah. Which goes the opposite way. It speeds up death penalty, so you say no.
Exactly.
You say no to 66, and you say yes to the real death penalty one, which is 62. Yes on 62, no on 66, no on 65, yes on 67, they're a pair. And in L.A. County, let me do a shout-out against RRRR. You remember that because it's the Pirate Initiative, which is bad, which is DWP trying to get more control and take the power. DWP wrote it, and they want to remove the power of city council and the mayor over rate hikes, over contracts. They just want to do it themselves, and they do everything so very, very poorly. We don't want them doing it without oversight by elected leaders.
Right.
So that's
they're
no on RRR.
They're a world to themselves, a kind of socialist mafia of people that hand down their jobs to their kids.
It's horrid. And that part of this actually is changing the civil service protection, but it's backed by that union, the IBEW union leader, who has all those corrupt deals with the taking money for their foundations. Brian Darcy is behind this because he wants an even cozier deal. Well, that's what we call RRR, the rotten ratepayer ripoff. So you remember it easy. You're knowing RRR.
Well, just though, in closing, we've got to wrap up real quick in the last few seconds here, Jamie. It looks to me that the whole idea of the proposition process was to bring the power back to the people, away from the railroad companies that controlled Sacramento in those days. It looks now like the big corporations are taking them over. I mean,
look, we got more with 61.
That's true.
We got the death penalty. I mean, they've got a couple, but they're big. There are some, you know, the special interest farmers, the Charlie Mungers. Some of them aren't bad ideas. They still have to get by the public, and that's the point is. You can see through them. So I feel okay about the initiative process this year. 17 ballot measures.
Just look at the small print, particularly on No on 61, where it says funding by Merck and Pfizer. Thanks a lot, Jamie, for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog, and his latest book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.